We all have a story to tell. Let's tell yours. Welcome to the Intellectual People Podcast with your host, Jason. Come together and listen to journey stories and more from interesting people. Welcome your host, Jason.
Welcome to the Intellectual People Podcast. I often post on forums, and I'd like to personally thank those forum owners for allowing me to post on those forums. In no particular order, they are audioscienceReview.com, audiocircle.com, audioshark.org, audiophilestyle.com, AV Nirvana, which is also the home of Room EQ Wizard and Audio Lens, DIYAudio.com, Gears.com, and Parts Express Forum. Thank you so much and enjoy. Today on the Intellectual People Podcast, I have Matt from Roswell Pro Audio. How are you doing today, Matt?
I'm doing well, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Great. What is Roswell Pro Audio?
Roswell Pro Audio is a boutique microphone company. So we design, build, and sell microphones primarily for studio recording as opposed to stage performance, for example. But we have a lot of customers really in two camps. There's people who have commercial recording studios, and then there's a lot of people, especially nowadays, especially with the pandemic, who are building home studios. So they are not professional musicians necessarily, but they like to play whatever their instrument is, guitar or vocals or drums or bass and so on. And they record themselves at home because home recording has become very, very accessible over the past 15 years. And so it's entirely possible to produce what would by anyone's standards be considered professional quality results using affordable gear at home. And so that's a big market for us.
Okay. I see a drum set in the background. Are you a drummer?
I am. Yeah. I regret that I have not as much time to play as I would like. But this room was built for that. This is a room within a room, you know, very well insulated with some good sound treatment. So the room sounds good, and I don't. Because, drumming is one of those things where you kind of have to do it a lot or you lose the edge. And so, I'd like to play more.
Were you a musician, a drummer as a child?
I was, yeah, to the extent that drummers are musicians. Apologies to other drummers. Yeah, I've been playing since high school. Okay. Maybe even before then.
So that's what got you interested in music, per se.
It is. Yeah. I've been around music all my life and came to it at a relatively young age and played in bands throughout high school and college and even since then. I was in a band in the 90s, and we made a CD, and I wouldn't say to say that we toured would be stretching it. I mean, we definitely gigged all around the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, but we never really officially toured. But, you know, we were looking for management and hanging flyers and had a mailing list and really trying to build a thing. And so, yeah, it was more than a hobby. It was a pretty serious thing for a while.
Is that band still in existence?
No, we all went our separate ways. I mean, we stay in touch, but the band was never went anywhere, unfortunately.
So you all got real jobs in the end, huh?
Yeah, well, we had real jobs, you know, to some extent, all the way through. Sure. Someone had to pay for all those flyers.
Understood. What'd you go to college for?
Something else entirely. I'm a little jealous of people who figure out at a younger age what it is they want to do. Because you know, you've probably heard the expression, youth is wasted on the young.
Yeah.
And that's something that young people don't understand because they are young and they don't know what they're missing. You know, add 20 years, then they'll be like, oh, now I get it. You know, if only I had done these things, researched these things. So I didn't know what I wanted to do. I thought I did, but not really. I wasn't really drawn to anything. I studied psychology.
Interesting.
Computers and technology always came easily to me. So even back in high school, I was programming a lot, not for school. I don't think my high school even had any kind of coding program at all. Right. But I taught myself a couple different languages and I did a lot of coding. all through high school. And then in college, I definitely took some of the coursework, and I had a minor in computer. I don't know what they called it. I don't remember what they called it, but it was not super technical, but it gave me at least some exposure to some of the coding classes.
Okay.
And that's something that, you know, like I said, it's always come easily to me, and I've definitely relied on it. So, you know, my educational background doesn't really serve me in any capacity now. I kind of wish I could go back in time and get a double E degree. Electrical engineering, I think, would be super useful.
Sure.
Because it's harder to learn that stuff on your own later.
Right.
But more interesting as well. I think one of your audiences for this is, I think, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think, you know, one of your goals is to try to expose some journey stories and the lessons therein for other people.
Correct.
I'd stop far short of pretending I can give meaningful life advice to almost anyone, except to say, try to figure out what you like. And if you don't know what that is and can't do that, I would say expose yourself to a lot of different things and see what is interesting. And I think, unfortunately, I think that's a really big challenge for a lot of younger people now, because digital entertainment in the form of, you know, streaming stuff, right? YouTube and Netflix and whatever, Hulu and a million other channels, and interactive content, meaning games, they're pervasive and addictive. And I think it would be very easy to not pursue anything because you have the world's entertainment at your fingertips. So why should I go learn about robotics or electronics or some kind of crafting when I can queue up, you know, a 17 season TV show and binge it for the next 4 days? And so I think the world's a harder place now for people to pursue their passions, but
I agree.
I would still recommend people try.
Great message. What was your first job out of college?
Wow. Not a meaningful one. It was a big accounting firm. I was doing
they all mean some something.
No, I was, it meant, how quickly can I get out of here? It got me to California. I moved to California in order to take this job.
Okay.
And that was, it was useful for that because that set the stage for a lot of things down the line. But in and of itself, I wouldn't say that it was an important stepping stone for me. It was really just a matter of, it got me an apartment, right?
Sure.
Got the rent paid. And
absolutely.
You know, there's a really, really great message from Steve Jobs. I think it was in 2005, and it's on YouTube. It's his commencement address at Stanford. And, you know, Steve Jobs is kind of an amazing person for a lot of reasons. Certainly the things he created have changed the world.
Absolutely.
And people might find fault with certain aspects of, you know, his story. But, you know, when is that not the case? But anyway, one of the points he makes in this commencement address is don't settle. Figure out what you want to do and look around until you find it and don't settle. And he says that two or three times in this 12 or 15 minute address.
Yep.
And that is amazing advice. And it's not advice that I followed. I absolutely settled. I favored stability at that point in my life. And,
sure.
But it at least gave me the opportunity to have some stability and then look for something else. And so from there, I went into a long series of other jobs that were much less buttoned down and much more fulfilling. I basically taught myself coding and software testing.
Okay.
And then I did software testing for years and working for a succession of very small companies. I liked working for small companies because it seemed more interesting to me, but small companies tend to go out of business.
Right.
And at one point I made a collage of the logos of all the companies I'd worked for. And it was, there were like 12 of them, you know, filled this grid. And it was cool because logos are cool as a design statement.
Sure.
All these colorful pieces of identity where people had gotten together and said, this is, you know.
Yeah.
At one company I was at, they had a meeting to unveil the X. This company called Chaos Tools, spelled X-A-O-S. And they made super cool graphic software. There was a Photoshop plugin and some animation software. And they hired a firm to design the X. I mean, how cool is that? That you can focus that sort of resources on something to represent right. you. Anyway, so I really liked working for small companies, and as a result of that, had to work for a lot of them. But along the way, you know, got into a band situation and taught myself more coding and web development and became a webmaster and taught myself databases and built databases for websites and, you know, developed some skills with technical writing. And a lot of the stuff did come back to play. You know, database skills I still use today. Technical writing, I do all the manuals for my DIY line of products. I write all the manuals for the Roswell stuff too, write all the content for the website. So a lot of the stuff came back into play, but, you know, circling back to, you know, what this means to anybody else, try a lot of things, learn a lot of things. You know, it's for my generation, people talked about, you know, resume padding. Like, I don't really care about this, but it's going to look good on my resume.
Right.
So for those who don't know, a resume is a document that describes your work experience so that the next guy hires you. I don't know that those are used anymore. I haven't hired anyone with a resume in a while. So resumes maybe not so relevant, but if you think about that as like more of a, if the metaphor would be more like a toolbox, you know, what can I learn that I can stick in my toolbox as a skill?
Right.
So that in 6 months or 10 years, I'll say, oh, I know how to do that. Whether it's changing the oil or, you know, making embossed brass logo badges for a product, could be a shoe or a microphone or anything else. But right, I mean, there's a skill there where you figure out, how do I do this? And then you apply that skill later. So, but you have to build the toolbox. And my experience and suspicion is that if your life is consumed by passive entertainment, then you tend not to have much of a toolbox. You've read about things and seen things done, but you've never actually done anything yourself. I mean, if that's true, it's going to be harder later, because you just have limited skills.
Let's talk about how you got to Roswell. I don't want to just jump into like Roswell all of a sudden started. So tell me how Roswell came about in the infancy of it.
Yeah. So, you know, Roswell is kind of act three or act four. So I had a couple of prior careers. And again, I don't want to make this sound more grand than it was, but I went from kind of a management consulting thing to a QA thing to a coding thing to a web development thing, and then got interested in home recording. And this is kind of in the early days of home recording.
Okay.
And I had the unfortunate, or the misfortune, I should say, of playing an instrument that requires a lot of microphones. You know, I was really jealous of people who play guitar or sing, and they need one microphone and they plug it in. And in those days, there were things called sound cards. So you'd actually plug a device into your computer and it would have some kind of input jack, quarter inch or something, or RCA, or, and then you'd plug in, you know, some kind of audio device, and you could record one or two tracks with one of those things. That doesn't work well for drums, where you need at least three, if not 10 or 15 microphones and a lot of inputs. But I started buying microphones and expanding my gear so that I could do recording at home, because I was playing in, you know, with various combinations of people and trying to record. And 1 year, my goal for the year was to be on, you know, four CDs, like to contribute drum tracks to some number of CDs.
Okay.
But I needed to record at home to do that. And so I started researching microphones and learning enough. And I, you know, one of the things that one of the skills that I have, is the ability to, focus and really get into the weeds on something, to go really, really deep. And I don't do that with a lot of things, because I'm not interested in them, and I'm terrible at doing things that don't interest me. Just don't have any ability to work on something that I don't care about. Can't do it at all. Show me a general ledger and I'll be out the door, you know, before you lay it on the table. Right. And I mentioned that example only because it's happened.
Right.
But so I got into microphones and I started studying them, and I thought, you know, it would be sure great if someone, and in those days there was a lot of companies that would say, hey, we're going to make this new microphone, but it would be identical to someone else's microphone.
Right.
Meaning you take the body off and inside is a circuit, and you could hold the two up and they'd be the same thing, because what, you know, these companies were, the terminology at that time was like rebranders or rebadgers. And so you're basically buying the Alktron model. Well, one was the T11A, which is a big tube mic. And the Alktron T11A showed up as the Apex 460 and the Carvin CTM-100. And I don't know how many other microphones that were basically the same thing, or if not exactly the same thing.
Interesting.
And so I thought, you know, someone needs to make a database where you can go on and say, what's the equivalence? This mic is also that, because I think I want this one, but if I can't find one of these to buy, why don't I buy that one? Because it's the same thing anyway. It's got a different logo on the front. And I wanted to be, and this dates me, but then again, everything I say does date me, but there was a guy called David Horowitz, who was kind of like a consumer advocate. And I thought, I kind of want to be the David Horowitz of microphones. I want to be able to tell people the truth, you know, or Consumer Reports might be a good sort of comparison where you tell the truth, like what's going on with this. And that's, so that was my first project in the audio business. And that turned into a website called Recording Hacks. And that website still exists. And there's still an editor who works on it and still updates it. And that website has profiles for over 1,000 microphones. And the idea of it is it's a very objective description of what every microphone is. And as I got into that project, I realized that these things are not just black boxes. You know, microphones, there's a certain kind of capsule, not in this one because I haven't installed it yet, but there's a circuit and there's a capsule, and these things have different contributions to the sound. And so I thought, okay, well, if I want to tell someone about this particular microphone, I have to tell them what the capsule is. I have to tell them what the circuit is. And so we started getting these microphones in and looking at them, taking pictures of the insides and saying, okay, well, this is a transformerless circuit. And this one has a K47 capsule or whatever. And so we started documenting things that way. And then I started buying old mics on eBay so I could photograph them. I would have vendors send me stuff for review and we'd do shootouts and all that. And so Recording Hacks became this whole thing and introduced me to a lot of great people in the industry. I got to meet people at a bunch of microphone companies who I totally looked and continue to look up to, because it's a tough business and people who are doing good work deserve, you know, recognition and praise. So that was a lot of fun. I started going to trade shows and meeting all the people there and meeting the makers and having conversations with the makers about certain things. I remember one really meaningful one was the guy who was at the time the head of R&D at Neumann in Germany. And I was able to ask him questions because I said, well, you know, this other company's in their marketing says, you know, A, B, and C about their capsules. And he's like, yeah, that's, you know, BS. We tested that and it doesn't, you know, it's kind of like mountain grown coffee. Right. I don't remember in the 70s or 80s, some company said mountain grown coffee and someone else said, well, it's all mountain grown. Like that's where it grows. But if you don't know that, then it sounds good.
Sure.
So there's marketing and that's different from engineering. But anyway, that was Recording Hacks. And then that got me into the DIY upgrade business. There's a certain percentage of the population that has the hot rodder gene. Mm-hmm. And it means I'm going to buy this older thing and I'm going to make it better. Not everybody has that. But it's an interesting way to pursue a lot of things. And it can get you in trouble as well. I remember one time I had an old switch, an Ethernet switch or something that was the fan in it died and I was going to replace the fan. And I started researching fans and I was going to buy, I found the fan and it was, you know, had higher CFM and it was a bearing fan. So it was really quiet. And I was all like geeking out on fan specs. And my wife said, why don't you just buy another switch? It hadn't occurred to me.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, you're right. Like, I don't want to import a fan from Europe and then take it apart and then put this in and maybe it doesn't work. And then the new switch costs less than the fan, you know, it's just right. Silly. So yeah, this can go off the rails.
And it should be mentioned, Matt, that hot rodding something, as you call it, doesn't necessarily always equal better performance in the end. It's very easy, correct me if I'm wrong or if you disagree, that you can modify something and it actually be worse than the manufacturer intended it to be. Or if you're fortunate enough or have the skill set to do so, you can modify it and it be far superior than what the manufacturer had, because it's built to a price point.
Yeah, both of those things are true and they are exclusive. So you're talking about two different things, but it's a really good point that you raise. And I've seen both. So you can spend time on some of the audio forums and you'll see people say, you know, I bought microphone X and I put in this transformer and now it's 10 times better. Right. Or worse, they'll say, all you have to do is change that capacitor to whatever brand they ascribe magical properties to. And it's a bit silly, you know. In the case of transformers, transformers are not interchangeable. You know, they do a certain job. They have ratios where they're changing voltages and things in a certain way, and you can't just take any old transformer and expect it to behave properly. It can change the performance. I mean, in a very common case that people say, "Oh, this is the magical thing," It actually cuts output by 3 decibels, this particular combination of this one transformer that people like to have because the brand name is supposed to be having superpowers, and then whatever cheap microphone that they'd like to put it into. It actually cuts output by 3 decibels. Now, maybe you don't care if you're recording something loud, but for most people, losing 3 dB is a bad deal because circuit noise tends to be constant. But if you shave 3 decibels of signal off the top, then your signal to noise ratio just got worse by 3 decibels, which sucks. Like, nobody wants that.
Right.
And then this whole idea that you can change one capacitor is silly. It's frankly silly. And a lot of people have said, and a lot of people, I mean, I see posts on forums where people make these claims, and it's silly because if there was a 50-cent upgrade that would make a mic 10 times better, you got to believe the factory would do it. You know, why wouldn't they? Now, the second part of what you said is, you know, you can build things that end up better than the original. That's actually not that hard because, as you say, a lot of products, especially in the sub $500 range, are built to a price point. And so certain compromises are made.
Sure.
And if you replace interior parts, I don't mean one part, but if you replace a circuit or a capsule, you can absolutely change the mic for the better. I mean, that's, you know, my business, Microphone Parts, is based on that premise and has, you know, you can look at the website. There's thousands of customer reviews that are of people saying, oh my God. And my favorite are the ones that say, you know, I didn't want to believe the hype. And I think, hype? Like, we don't advertise. I don't know what hype you saw. But they say, you know, I didn't want to believe it, but then I did it and oh my God. And I'm like, you know what? That's the hype that the next guy's going to complain about. Like, it's your fault.
Right.
So yeah, it's possible to build stuff. And the other aspect of DIY in terms of audio is that you can personalize things.
Sure.
You know, so we sell circuit kits and we sell capsules. And if you want a certain kind of sound, a certain kind of voicing, you can pick this capsule or that capsule. And maybe that's a combination that nobody else actually makes, you know, but it's what you need. And that's fine. I mean, there are so few right answers, like objectively right answers in audio, as you know. So yeah, there's the personalization factor and there's the price performance factor. Those are two of the biggest reasons to do DIY. But to finish the earlier answer, you know, recording hacks led to me developing and selling DIY upgrades for microphones. Okay. And then that led to people asking me, can you just build it for me? Which suggested that which I denied for years. I didn't want to believe was true, but suggested that there's a market for this stuff, meaning pre-built. And okay. So Roswell Pro Audio was developed to answer that question. Like, you know, can you design and build something for me? And I thought, okay, well, I'll, you know, it's difficult to do one-offs,
right?
You know, one-off custom mics, which we do that as well now as we've expanded our capabilities. But, you know, in those earlier days when we just didn't have the bandwidth for that sort of stuff,
sure.
I thought, well, we need to develop a small collection of products that, you know, I mean, so the Roswell products are based on the most popular DIY upgrades that Mic Parts sells. So we take the recipes, if that's the right word for it, but you know, the circuit capsule voicing combinations from Mic Parts that I know appeal to people because we sell a bunch of them as kits. And then I elaborate that into something else for Roswell. And it might be, you know, upgrading everything. It might be adding a bunch of features. It might be keeping the cost down. What, you know, there's some other ingredient goes into the mix in order to develop the Roswell version of it. So, but that's the roundabout way of how Roswell came about.
It almost sounds like you now need a company called Bespoke Microphones for the one-offs.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, you know, in the early, it's interesting for me anyway, I don't know if anyone else cares, but in the early days, Mic Parts was strictly DIY. Like, we wouldn't build it for you. I would say, no, I'll refer you to someone to build it. And then Roswell was strictly finished products. And now, though, Mic Parts sells finished mics, including customized and platinum versions, platinum being like the kind of the bespoke, you know, unobtainium parts. And then Roswell is also offering custom shop stuff where we can do, you want higher sensitivity, we can do that. You want more or less second harmonics, we can do that. You want a different voicing? Yeah, we can probably do that too. You want a different color? Yeah, we've got custom colors. So we've kind of, we're kind of doing everything, you know, including the one-off and custom stuff too.
So do the two companies, obviously you operate both companies, right?
Yeah. I own both companies. I develop all the products. Yeah.
You do all the development as well?
Product development. Yeah, I would say microphone development. So we've got some non-microphone products in various stages of R&D that I'm not doing the development on. I'm participating, but I'm not the, okay. I'm not the core circuit designer for the non-microphone stuff.
Understood. The mic parts division, do you find that primarily people are doing DIY, or are they really just buying that and having you assemble them mainly?
Mic parts primarily sells kits still.
They do. Okay.
It was because, you know, like I said, we don't advertise, you know, I mean, you can, most people, if they want a microphone, they're going to call their Sweetwater sales guy, you know, and that's how most people buy microphones. They're going to go online. They're going to call a sales guy at a dealer. And they'll never hear about microphone parts because microphone parts isn't represented in any of those channels. The only way to know about us is to find us online and order direct.
Right.
Now there's a big price advantage for those people who do that. However, those products are designed for people who want to solder it themselves. And we go to incredible lengths to make that a reasonable task. But if you've never soldered before, this is a terrible way to spend your money because, you know, you need to learn, like you need to have certain skills. You know, you don't, when you're 16 and you haven't learned how to drive yet, you don't go out and buy a Ferrari, right? That would be a big mistake. So DIY kits cost less than comparable commercial products. And part of the reason is that you're doing the assembly yourself. And part of the reason is that you're taking the risk of something going wrong on for yourself.
Right.
Now, if you're comfortable with those risks and that trade-off, then you can buy a kit for, you know, $350 or $360 that will stand up against a $3,000 microphone. And that's not bragging. That's my customers telling me, hey, I put this mic up against a $3,000 microphone and I was laughing about it because I liked mine better. So that's a real thing. And so, yeah, Mic Parts is known for kits and mostly sells kits. What surprised me is beginning about a year and a half ago that we started getting regular orders for the finished product. And that was just a case of word getting around because, like I said, it's not easy to find us. Like someone has to tell you, no, this is the one that you want and you have to order it. And it's slow because we build them to order. So it's not like Amazon where you ordered on Monday and it shows up Tuesday afternoon or whatever. This is something where you order it and it shows up a week later because we just built it for you. So it's not a traditional, you know, consumer product kind of experience. It is literally a hand-built custom boutique product. But it surprised me that a year and a half ago, people were okay with that. They just wanted to wait. And business has grown quite a bit over the past year, partly due to the pandemic and everyone's working at home, and which means musicians need home studios and, you know, non-musicians are building like a Zoom teleconference system for home. And then word started getting out, for example, within the animation voiceover community. So there's a whole group of people who do all the character voices for all kinds of video games and animations and anime and all this different stuff. And they've been telling, you know, like the shampoo commercial, and they told two friends. So we're selling a bunch of a certain Mic Parts mic into that community as a voiceover mic because people don't have the $3,000 budget, and a lot of other mics between, you know, the $3,000 price and what we charge, that particular mic is like $600 or something. So between those two numbers, there's really not a lot to pick from that sounds as good.
Right.
So we do sell some, but it still skews DIY as it should. You know, that's what the company started for, and that's what it's known for.
And then Roswell, explain to me the difference of the kits, other than the kits being kits and Roswell mics being fully assembled. What sonic differences are there really?
That varies from model to model.
Okay.
So, but I'll give you an example. So the original mic that Roswell came out with is called the Mini K47. So that's the first mic we came out with. And although we've improved it a couple of times, we still make that same model. And that was based on a Mic Parts kit called the S47. And so they differ in a number of ways. One is that the S47 has higher output by 6 to 10 decibels. So the S47 was really designed more for vocals and acoustic guitar, whereas the Mini K47, you know, the reality of selling a product like that is that you don't know what the audience is going to use it for. And right. So, you know, the mics that Roswell makes, someone could put it on a bass cab, a piano, you know, a flute, something really quiet, or they could put it on a kick drum. You just never know. And so in the Mini K47, the sensitivity is dialed down to give it a little bit more headroom. And so S47, though, you know, again, higher output, it has almost entirely different components, top to bottom, different JFET, different resistors, different output transistors. The topology of the circuit is very similar, but not exactly the same. And then the S47 has an internal switch that, and this is what I said before, this goes back to what I said before about how you can personalize gear. We try to build in some customization options to a lot of the DIY stuff.
Okay.
So that when you build it, when the customer builds it, he or she can determine, like, what does this switch do? Do I want some high frequency roll off, you know, to make it a little darker or more neutral or that sort of thing? So in this particular mic, actually both those options exist. But the switch can be either a 10 decibel pad or a cardioid omni pattern switch. The Mini K47 doesn't have any switches. The point of the Mini K47 was that it is what we say, you know, point and shoot simple. Like you set it up, point it at the source and hit record.
Gotcha.
Doesn't need to be configured or, you know, specially treated or anything like that. The price on the two is similar. They're both right around $350. But the Mini K47 has a warranty, has a shock mount, has a case. The S47 has a swivel mount and no case, and you have to build it. And sometimes when people ask, you know, what's the difference? I say, well, the Mini K47 is a $500 microphone that you get for $350, and the S47 is a $1,000 microphone that you get for $350, but you have to build it.
Ah.
So that's another way to hold on to it. But all of them are different, and they're all different in different ways. The original Delphos was based on the S87. And then the Delphos 2, we added two other polar patterns. So we're just, you know, we're adding features. In DIY, it's hard to do switches well. Just, adding switches, depending on the interior layout. But oftentimes, especially with Chinese-made microphone bodies, which is, you know, that's what the DIY stuff is targeted at. Because right. People are buying inexpensive mics from Guitar Center. Any one of many familiar brands, and they're all made at one of three or four factories in China. I mean, for the most part, I'm simplifying a little bit, but a lot of that metalwork is sort of commoditized there. Right. So you'll see the same microphone body show up in four different brands. Sometimes the insides are the same, as I mentioned before, and sometimes not so much, but the metalwork is often very similar. And the way that they do switches is there's often a separate small round circuit board that the switches are mounted on. But in terms of a DIY kit, that means you have a second circuit board or a third. It means you have switches, which themselves tend to be expensive. It means you have to wire the switchboard to the rest of the circuit, which is a pain because wiring is three or four times harder than soldering components to a circuit board, you know, especially for neophytes. So it adds a lot of cost and complexity. And in many cases, doesn't do any favors for the audio quality either, because you've got these long wires and this extra circuit board, and so your audio signal's traveling extra inches and stuff. So
sure.
It's just not a great setup the way those things were designed. So we try to do switches different ways. In the Delphos 2, we do have switches, and on the Kolaris as well. Those are the two big mics from Roswell, but the switches aren't on separate boards where they're wired. They're soldered directly to traces on the main audio board. Cause that's just a better way to do it.
Would you mind going through each Roswell model and not tell me what one would use for what, but in general, what each one is targeted towards?
Yeah, I can do that. I can show a couple of pictures too.
That'd be great.
I have, so the first one, like I said, was called the Mini K47, and that looks like this, if that's showing on the screen. And so the Mini K47 is a compact microphone, very simple to use. And the nice thing about it is it doesn't sound like most other microphones. You know, a lot of inexpensive microphones, as you have mentioned, tend to embrace a sort of overbright frequency response. And I don't want to get super technical about, you know, why that might be, but what happens is, I mean, even people who are not deeply into audio know that on your home stereo or your home theater, there's often like a treble and a bass control, and the treble control makes the high frequencies louder.
Right.
And so when you turn that up or push it to the right, cymbals get brighter and mouth sounds and S sounds get exaggerated and things like that. A lot of microphones just sound like that, especially inexpensive microphones. And younger, less experienced engineers will sometimes use one of those, and they think that sounds good. They think what they're hearing is detail. But the reality is that sound can become harsh pretty quickly. And as people's ears get more developed, right, as you become a better listener, which happens as you're recording more and mixing more music, you start to realize that sort of exaggerated top end or exaggerated high frequency response, I've also heard it called toppy or bright, it can become harsh. And I often end up saying this, quoting Ross Hogarth, who's an engineer who's worked with a ton of artists. He says digital, meaning digital recording, is very unforgiving of harshness. There are technical reasons for that your pal Tom Christensen could probably go into in more detail. But in very brief and somewhat unfair terms, digital filters can create distortion or harshness if they're fed too much high frequency information. Again, apologies to the DSP engineers out there, but that's kind of what people experience from it. So it's not just that the mic is too bright and sounds bad on its own. It's that once it goes through your digital converters, it sounds even worse. So a lot of microphones are voiced that way. And so the Mini K47, to circle back to what I was saying, it has a different capsule in it, and it doesn't sound like that at all. It has a presence bump in the upper mids, 4 or 5 kilohertz, and then the top end above that is very neutral. And so what you get out of that is vocal articulation without hissiness or tizziness or sharp S's. And so it just sounds, rounder and fuller and is easy to understand without having to be louder and without hurting your ears when you turn it up. So that's the Mini K47. It was the first mic we made. There was a definite hole in the market for a microphone like that. The particular combination that we were doing hadn't really been done before in the way that we were doing it. It's since been copied. The idea has been copied, so that mic is a really popular model. And what's surprising to me is that, I know you didn't want to ask about sources, and it is hard for me to talk about sources because the truth is I don't play 50 instruments, so I can't try microphones on 50 instruments.
Understood.
But when I design something, there's definitely a target application in mind.
Right. And that's all I'm looking for.
Yeah. And so, but what surprised me is that people love it on a bunch of sources that I hadn't ever considered. So the Mini K47 has become a go-to solution for diverse things like piano, drum overheads, vocals, drum room. So a lot of different and kind of different sounding things. Like, what does drum room have in common with piano?
Right.
Not a lot.
Yeah.
But what we're learning is that the microphone it captures sounds in the way people like to hear them. And so it tends to work well on a bunch of different sources. So that's the Mini K47. One of the next ones, I'll jump. So this was, I think, the third or fourth mic we made. It's called the Mini K87. And it was kind of a natural extension because it's the same mic with a different sonic color. Okay. It's a different color paint too, but that's not what I mean. The Mini K87 has a different capsule in it, which is what the 87 refers to. It's not a U87 clone. It's not a U87 tribute. It simply isn't a U87. You know, if you want a Neumann U87, take $3,000 to Sweetwater. They'll be happy to set you up. The Mini K87 is a mic that I designed. It uses, you know, a capsule based on a German original design. It uses a circuit based on a European design. The combination plus a bunch of kind of upgrades that we've done to it make it unique. And it's a sonic alternative to the 47 in the sense that it sounds different. So it doesn't have that upper mid-range bump. It's got a flatter frequency response.
Okay.
It's a little brighter out at 10 to 12K, not because it's bright, but because it's flat. And the 47 is starting to roll off. I'm mimicking a frequency response graph because I look at them all day long, but the 47 is a little boosted at 4 to 5K and then kind of rolls off above that, and the 87 is flat out beyond that. I shouldn't get into probably this much detail even, but the point is that they sound different.
And I love
it. Here's an example story. We work with Craig and Sarah, ukulele players, and they play a bunch of different ukuleles and they endorse them, and now they're working with a ukulele manufacturer, I believe, but they'll have these day-long podcasts, is not the right word, like live stream performance seminar hang.
Okay.
So we set them up with a mixed pair, what we call a mixed pair, which is a Mini K47 and a Mini K87, which I actually have a picture of here. And so it's basically just two mics in a box, and but it's not a stereo pair. The point is that these two microphones sound different, and intentionally so, right? We sent them the pair and they tried them. They each tried the mics on one of their ukuleles. And they said, wow, we're head over heels for the Mini K47. Can we get another one of those? Like, can we swap the 87 for the 47? I said, well, you could, absolutely. And I'll take care of you. And I said, just send back the 87 and we'll swap that out. And, you know, in microphones, there isn't a good or a bad or a better or worse. I mean, there's a lot of subjectivity there. There are certainly audible flaws in microphones, like harshness, that can cause problems, you know, during playback and especially during mix time, right? So there are some things that maybe do cross the line into badness, okay? But in general, there's a lot of subjectivity about what microphone sounds better on one thing or another. And, you know, I'm not ever going to tell an artist, no, you need to like this mic. Right. You know, like, I don't know what their ears, like, well, how, you know, I call this blue. I don't know what you're looking at. Right. You know, what you think is blue might be green. We'll never know, because these are just words that we use to describe this sensory experience. And the same is true with microphones. I don't know what you're hearing, but I respect your opinion about what you want. So I said, yeah, I'll swap the mic out. And a day goes by or 2 days go by, and they emailed again and said, never mind. We get it. We tried the 87 on this other instrument, and that's the win. You know, on that instrument, the 47 is a little too rich in the mids,
right?
Or whatever they said, right? But the point is, every instrument has its own sound and favors a different microphone. That's why we make microphones that sound different. You know, right. I know of companies, I could make a list of companies that make a bunch of mics that look different, but sound exactly the same. Hmm. I never understood that. Of course, they sell more than I do, so maybe I should take a lesson, but that doesn't interest me. And like I said before, I suck at doing things that don't interest me. So.
Right.
Every mic I make sounds different. We target voicings very specifically. We develop these voicings very specifically. So the Mini K87 sounds different than the 47. It's the same size. The shock mount is the same, but it sounds different. Then the Delphos 2 is one of the larger body mics. It's a three pattern mic. It's the only three pattern mic we make. And that's kind of our all purpose do anything, you know, in my opinion and experience. Neutrally voiced microphones are more universally applicable. The more a microphone is trying to impose its own sound on a source, the fewer sources it's going to work with. Now, the caveat is some combinations might be magic. You know, if you have a mic with a lot of character, you might find that on a particular voice or instrument or guitar, it is the best thing you've ever heard on that voice or instrument or guitar. I get that. I love that. That's awesome. But that microphone on the next voice might be like, yeah, I can't, like, it's not that it's okay. It's like, no, I don't want that. Right.
Right.
So the Delphos 2 is very, very neutral. And therefore, you know, by this model, pretty universally applicable on a lot of different sources. And that is the feedback that we get from people as well. And then the last, the Kolaris is the other big mic. It's kind of our flagship big vocal big vocal mic.
Okay.
It's a little brighter. But we're talking, you know, in my world, bright means plus 1 dB, plus 2 dB, not plus 5 or 6. You know, if you add 5 or 6 dB at 10K, that's like an ice pick to the ear.
Right.
I could make a list of mics that sound like that right out of the box, and I can't use any of them. So the Kolaris is brighter than the other models that we make by a dB or two, a decibel or two. But the magic touch of the Colaris is that it adds second order harmonic coloration, which is one of the sonic characteristics of vintage tube microphones. It's one of the reasons that people love and revere these old vintage European tube mics like the U47 and the Elam 251 and U67 and so on, because those microphones impart a little bit of a saturated quality to the sound, which is hard to get otherwise. Now, you know, modern technology being what it is, you can buy preamps that will add saturation. You can use tape emulator plugins in your digital workstation that do some of this too. But engineers have, you know, learned and have certainly taught me that you kind of want to get the sound from the mic whenever you can. Like, you don't want to record something and then rely on fixing it later.
Right.
So the Colaris attempts to do this in the mic. It attempts to give you that tube mic sound without the cost or complexities or hassle of a tube mic. I mean, tube mics are great, but they need to warm up. Tubes are fragile because they're literally made of glass in most cases. Tubes can become noisy. They can go bad. They can become noisy and microphonic. And so there's a maintenance thing, and they're just harder to use. The Colaris is phantom powered. You plug it in, press that plus 48 button on your preamp or interface, and record. You know, 15 seconds later, it's warmed up and ready to cook, and it sounds great. And so that's the Colaris. And the last one we make is a kick drum mic. It's the Mini K47KD. Started life as a custom shop mod of the Mini K47, where we would basically change the circuit to give it a bunch of extra headroom. And then the feedback from endorsees was so great. They were like, oh my God, this is the best kick drum mic. You know, like one of my guys, he's like, it's been on every drum I've recorded for the past 3 years.
Wow.
So, and he's a Nashville engineer. So he's recording drummers and drums all the time. And in every case, there's a Mini K47KD on the kick. So since that time, we've revamped the circuit to make it even better. We reduced the low frequency filtering, which in a day-to-day mic is an advantage. You know, you don't want subsonics in your podcast, for example. But in a kick drum mic, you know, open it up, because someone who's buying a $350 dedicated kick drum mic presumably knows how to use a shock mount and isolation and frequency appropriate filtering, right? So Anyway, we added headroom and removed low frequency filtering, and that's the KD, which is a surprisingly good seller. I mean, I say surprisingly because it's a $350 kick drum mic. You know, not everyone's got the budget for that, but some people do, because we're moving them.
What do you charge for assembly on the mic parts products?
It varies.
Okay.
You know, what we do is actually we don't sell the kit. So for people who want to buy the mic, they can just buy the mic. So there's actually a page on the website where you can just order the microphone.
Sure.
Because if you're not interested in DIY, it doesn't make sense to like buy the kit and then contract for labor.
Understood. You
know, just buy the product.
Yep.
Yeah.
In terms of the Roswell products, one of your, I don't like to use the word tagline. However, on your website, and which I absolutely love it, it says, science, not fiction. Explain to me the science behind that and the science behind your microphones, if you would.
Yeah. So, I mentioned Tom Christensen before.
Yep.
I met him, you know, virtually speaking through your podcast. Okay. And have since talked to him. We spent an hour and a half on the phone last week, which was just a joy.
Fantastic. I'm very happy to hear that.
Yeah. So for those of you who are watching this and don't know what I'm talking about, go back a couple of episodes to watch Tom Christensen. So he's the real deal. You know, he and I have a lot, like a surprising number of things in common. You know, he has a DIY line and then a kind of boutique branded products line, as do I. And a number of other parallels. Anyway, he embraces measurement. It's a point you brought out well in your interview. And that's part of the answer to your question, science, not fiction.
Yep.
You know, I mentioned before that I did this website called Recording Hacks for a long time. And so I was very, very familiar with the marketing claims made by everyone who I was covering at the time. You know, I was basically a journalist just in it for the joy. You know, I mean, the first design for Recording Hacks had no ad slots on it because I didn't want to be influenced by advertising. I'm like, no, I'm Consumer Reports, you know, this is all you can trust this and it's all my opinions, whatever. And so I had people tell me to my face, you know, I designed this microphone, and I find out, and I didn't know any better. I found out years later that it was, you know, catalog item from China. Like, you know, he didn't design it because everyone else sells the same thing and had been selling the same thing before he started selling it. So how did he design it? So anyway, I'm familiar with a lot of the claims. I remember one company that makes a lot of different microphones, their frequency response graphs are the same from one mic to the next, to the next, to the next. Why? I don't know. I can only speculate that someone in the marketing department is just copying and pasting, like, oh, we just need to, you know, open the cut sheet, right? The marketing right. page for this mic, change, you know, just copy it, change the product name, change the photo, done.
Yep.
Now, to be fair, it's the same microphone in a different body, but there's no effort there. Like that graph is not real. Like the original one wasn't accurate.
Right.
There's another company, very well-respected company. I consider them kind of mid-tier. And the graph for their microphone is this beautifully flat line. You know, we bought one, we swept it. That's not flat, not even close to flat. You know, that's a story that they're telling.
Now, let me interject there. Are you saying it's not flat because of the measurement, or are you saying that it's not flat because the way they present their measurement, maybe they filter it, they smooth it, the graph axes are not really to a standard.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, there isn't a standard for microphone testing. And there's a David Josephson of Josephson Microphones, somewhat famously, doesn't publish frequency graphs for any of his products because he says the only reason, well, I don't know, he didn't say these words to me, but so, and I don't want to put words in his mouth. My takeaway is, I think what he's saying is, if I were to publish graphs, you'd compare them to someone else, but someone else's graphs are measured at a different distance in a different size room at a different volume. And so it's apples and oranges. And you're right. going to pretend that they're the same because you're comparing them. You know, to compare them is to suggest that these two can be compared, but they can't. So I'm not even going to bother. And I totally respect that. I've gotten into some trouble because in the early days, you know, there's two numbers that come out, or two ways that this frequency information can be communicated about microphones. And one is the graph and the other is the frequency range. Everybody just says 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz, which is not true.
Right.
At some point, I was told or taught that you're supposed to quote the minus 3 dB point. So that means wherever your microphone's response falls off 3 decibels, that's yep. where you say the top of the bottom of the range is.
Correct.
And so some of my products would say, you know, 20 hertz to 15K, not 20K, but 15K. And I've had people call and say, well, I'm not going to buy yours because yours only goes to 15 and this other guy's goes to 20. And I'm like, okay, back up, you know? And so for a couple of years, I'm just like, all right, this number doesn't mean anything. I'm just going to put 20 to 20 because everybody else does. Like, why am I going to be the only guy out there? Not the only one, but why am I going to go to great pains to be honest where it costs me sales because someone who doesn't know the difference is basing their decision based on this. Why would I hurt myself that way? So that kind of thing is difficult. And as far as, you know, how other people make their graphs, I have no idea how or why other people make their graphs.
Why do
the
you
point? And I kind of, sorry to interrupt. I don't want to get deep into like, you know, throwing bricks at other people, but at all, but to answer the question about science, not fiction, we try to embrace some hard facts. Like we use this capsule because it sounds this way. We use this circuit because it gives us really fast and accurate transient response. Except in this mic, we use this other circuit because it gives us even order harmonic coloration and saturation, which we want. It's a sonic effect that we're intentionally including. It's not, none of this stuff is by chance.
Right.
You know, in the current production, Mini K47 and Mini K87, the circuits are very similar, but the components are different. Why? Because there's a certain kind of resistor that we use in one of them that sounds a certain way, and a different kind of resistor we use in the other one, and we use that because it sounds a certain way. So we're using the components to push the sonic identities where we want them, okay? So we listen to components. And, you know, of course, there's an argument to be made about, you know, do capacitors have a sound and do resistors have a sound? And, you know, some people hear things and some people don't. But I've seen enough ABX tests that suggest that certainly some people do, just like some people can taste certain components of wine or chocolate. I went to a chocolate tasting years ago, and the host was a self-described super taster. And so she could tell us things that I'm just like, yeah, it tastes like chocolate, you know?
Right.
But she could talk about, you know, vegetalness. I'm not sure that's a word, but, you know, she was getting components out of it. And I've seen that with wine as well and beer. So, you know, people sense things different ways, and some people sense more. They just do. They hear better, you know? Some people hear things that other people just don't hear. And that's okay. You know, we make mics for both.
Right.
You know, everyone's going to hear the capsule. That I know. Not everyone's going to hear the resistors. I'm okay with that. But we still put them in because there are people who will hear it, and it matters to us.
Fair enough.
So that's where the science, not fiction, comes from. We try not to tell stories. You know, what we do is we try to use good engineering and good measurement techniques and back up the claims. So when we come out with a product, it's not because we needed a microphone that's purple. You know, market research suggests that we could sell 10,000 purple microphones a month. I'm sure that conversation's taken place in this industry, but not in my shop.
Right.
You know, we build microphones for one reason and one reason only, and that's because I think it's cool.
Right.
You know, because I've come up with an idea that I think, and I don't know if anyone's going to buy it or not. You know, we've definitely missed the ball a few times on the mic part side, and that's okay. You know, we built something because I think it's cool and there's no market for it. Okay. You know, I still learned something, and it's still there for someone who wants to do that. We still have the product. But on the Roswell side, you know, we can't take too many, take too many wild swings, because you can't introduce a one-off product, you know, for that brand. But you know, we do have several new things in the pipeline that I think are going to be super cool. And early feedback, you know, from beta testers is certainly positive. So
are you willing to expound on what could be coming?
No, I appreciate the interest, but, you know, it's a weird thing. I've learned on the mic part side, if you suggest that something new is coming, people stop buying what you have on the assumption that the new thing is better, which isn't the case. And a lot, it's different, you know? I mean, we make a lot of different things and they all are good at different things.
Understood.
But we have a bunch of new things in various stages of development, but nothing we're ready to talk about just yet. Cause it's, Fair enough. if we end up not being able to make it, cause you know, the costs are too high or, you know, in some cases there's certain parts that just can't be had. Mm-hmm. So if we can't get them in enough quantity to do a production run, then it ends up being a, you know,
yep,
something we can't do. So
I get it. You say you measure your microphones and other microphones that have come through the shop. How do you measure a microphone? And why is there not a standard?
Well, as to why there's not a standard, you'd have to ask AES, and that question's been asked. And I don't participate at that level, in the standards body. I do think that the lack of a standard hurts consumers.
Agreed.
I remember one particular omnidirectional studio microphone that showed a lot of bass response, a lot more than I would expect, because omni capsules tend not to have any proximity effect. And so compared to a directional mic, they tend to sound thinner at the same distance. And the graph for this one showed pretty full bass response. And so I asked, so how did you get bass response out of an Omni mic? And they said, oh, well, we measure it, you know, 10 inches or something. I was like, oh, because everyone else measures it a half meter or a meter.
Right.
And I thought, well, that, okay, so that's, and you know, again, I'm not saying anyone's right or wrong because there's no standard. I mean, you do whatever you want. You know, by definition, you could do whatever you want because there's no rule. But from a consumer perspective, that response is only descriptive if you're using the mic at 10 inches,
right,
which, for example, wouldn't be true on drum overheads, right? That's going to be a lot farther than 10 inches from the things that have bass response. So I think it hurts consumers. Now, what we do to measure mics is we do frequency response testing, which also gets us sensitivity. And then we do noise testing. And it's, you know, a lot of these things are challenging to do well. And we're constantly improving our tools. We also do component level testing. You know, one of the circuits we use does has basically two symmetrical output circuits. So it's basically balanced at the JFET and then balanced output all the way out the mic. So it's, you know, two identical, equal amplitude, but reversed polarity output circuits. So they're matched. And so we match the capacitors in those two and the resistors too.
Sure.
But, you know, matching capacitors, you just need an LCR meter and you plug them all in and you bin them and then you select, you know, to, I'm not sure what we're at, something like probably 0.25% tolerance or something. I mean,
it's pretty tight.
It's tight just because, you know, because we can.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, once you've measured it, it's like, how many piles do you want?
Right.
You know, more piles is better accuracy. So,
yep.
So we shave them down really tight. Does it matter? You know, can anyone hear it? I don't know, but it's the right thing to do.
Sure.
You know, it's just a better way to do it. And it's not something anyone else does. So if that gives us an edge, then I'll take it. But yep. We do it anyway, because that's the right thing to do for me. So those are the kind of measurements that we do. And, you know, we are constantly improving the game. Measuring noise is very, very difficult because rooms are loud. You know, I mean, you're sitting in a quiet room. It doesn't seem very loud, but that's like 50, 60 dBA. And you're trying to measure something that's maybe 6 or 10. So, you know, you have to build a soundproof chamber, and there's a lot of conversations about good ways and bad ways to do that. And so we're on a sort of never-ending quest to improve our capabilities in that area. But none of that is what we take for granted.
Are you willing to tell us in a very basic way how you actually take your measurements?
I can talk about frequency measuring, sure.
Yeah, just basic frequency measuring. I mean, your setup?
Yeah, so when we do a frequency measurement, we have a custom speaker that was designed by an audio engineer who's done work for every big company you can name. Okay. And it was specifically designed for low phase response. So we have a very flat response amplifier that feeds into that. We have a measurement microphone, a professional quality measurement microphone that came with calibration data. And then we have analysis software. And so you can measure the rig using the calibration data from the microphone. So the microphone is basically compensated for. So the microphone is assumed to be flat. The speaker is not flat because transducers never are. But by doing that measurement with the microphone of sort of known response and calibrated response, then you can calibrate the rig so that just like the calibration data fixes the microphone's anomalies, that next measurement fixes the anomalies of your speaker and room. The software itself is doing time windowing so that when it plays 20 hertz, it's only listening for 20. And so that when that 20 hertz goes out into the room and comes back a millisecond later, or however long your reflection time is, it's already moved on to 24 and it's not going to listen to that 20 anymore, which would cause anomalies in the measurement, because then you're not measuring the mic, you're measuring reflections in the room.
Sure.
So that's it, you know, calibrated measurement mic, custom speaker, certain kind of amplifier, analysis software. And then we do the measurement. You know, the next upgrade is, it's in the works, and that would be a larger chamber, a more anechoic chamber. We don't have an anechoic chamber right now, but we're also not making measurements to be published. The ones that we publish, we send out to a third party lab and have those measurements done there because they're better set up for that. So what we do in-house is really comparison, because our room that we're in, you know, just a fact of life, we're making do with a room that's a little bit too small right now.
Yep.
And so, but we know what to look for. And for the most part, the issues that we're concerned about are above 1 kilohertz. In a smaller room where you're going to have more anomalies is going to be below that, well below that, you know, 300 and below. And so we don't tend to have issues there. And you know, what we see is like, you know, sometimes in a production run of capsules, you know, if there was a problem with the diaphragm tensioning or the spacing or the drilling, you know, if there's some kind of problem with the construction of the capsule, one of the ways that can manifest is that the capsule will have thin, low frequency response. So even in our room, we can see that in the graphs. And so that's enough for us to do QC. And so we can sweep the capsule and say, okay, this fails QC. And we put that aside for rework. But the rig is perfectly adequate for the kind of stuff that we have to do in house, which is, you know, sweeping every capsule on the DIY side and every mic on the Roswell side. And we have a gold master for most mics. So we've built one that's been heard by people with great ears, and we know that this mic is what this model is supposed to sound like. And so that we can sweep that one, meaning do a frequency response sweep test. It's we're playing a sine wave that starts at 20 hertz and goes up to, you know, 25 or whatever, however high we go. Right. So we'll play that through the gold master mic and see what that curve looks like. And then we'll put the subject mic in, and then we're doing a comparison to see if the new mic meets that spec.
And you do that on every built microphone that you build personally?
Absolutely. Yeah. And we store them all too. Every capsule as well. Every capsule that goes out and every,
really?
Every mic that goes out. Yeah. And that's, you know, not everybody does that.
Right.
There's a lot of popular brands that, you know, they're shipped from the port of Ningbo to the distributor, to the customer.
Yep.
You know, never been, I mean, they've been plugged in, I assume, at some point, but never been heard.
Right.
We don't do that. You know, all the Roswell models are actually built in California and tested here in my shop and extensively. Yeah. So, which is, you know, it's why we can offer a good warranty and we almost never have to use it.
Right. So. Matt, can you explain actually how a microphone works?
Yeah, I mean, without getting into crazy detail that would put any remaining awake listeners to sleep, you know, a microphone is basically a transducer. And what a transducer is something that takes energy from one form and turns it into another form. Everyone listening to this is listening through transducers, right? Your earbuds or speakers or whatever are microphones in reverse. They're taking in a voltage, which is an electrical energy, and turning it into vibrating air, which is a different kind of energy. Uh-huh. So the speaker in your earbuds or headphones is transducing a voltage into an acoustic energy that travels through the air and hits your eardrums. Microphone capsules do the same thing in reverse. So there's typically some kind of suspended membrane, and sound waves impact it and cause it to vibrate. And that vibration then, in one way or another, is turned into a voltage. And that voltage goes through a transformer or a circuit or both, usually to change impedance and sometimes to change the gain, and then can be recorded to magnetic media, or can be then digitized and recorded to digital media for later playback. So that, I mean, that's in broad strokes, that's how a microphone works. There's different kinds. I actually have a whole kind of masterclass on microphones that if folks are interested, I could share. There's various versions of it online. I did a version with Lyd Shaw, Recording Studio Rockstars. I did a version with Warren Hewitt, Produce Like a Pro. Both those guys have YouTube channels.
Okay.
There's excerpts of a version of it that I did at the University of Michigan's Audio Symposium. That's on the Roswell channel, and that's like the, you know, the football field-sized screen behind me. I'm exaggerating a little, but this enormous screen behind me. And, you know, for my slides, and then I'm standing in front giving this talk. So the excerpts from that are online as well. So that goes into the different kinds of microphones. So like there's ribbon mics, there's condenser mics, there's dynamic mics. Those words describe certain kinds of transducers, and they each have performance characteristics. You know, again, there's, like I said before, there's no good or bad. There's like rarely black and white, good or bad within audio. It's all trade-offs and subjectivity. So these things are just different ways to transduce sound, and they sound different, and they have different strengths and different weaknesses, from, you know, frequency response, distortion, SPL, all those kinds of things. So folks who are interested in going into a deeper dive on microphone technology should check those out.
And I'll link them below as well. I'll go over the links with you and I'll link them below.
Sure.
Why don't you make a dynamic stage mic?
That is a good question, and it's one I get all the time. And the answer is, because it's a lot harder to do well. It's easy to do poorly, but harder to do well. And I'm not going to do it if I can't do it well, right?
Sure.
Because why? Like, I, you know, my one of my associates, consultants, mentors, whatever, keeps telling me, you know, we're a sales organization. And I'm like, I guess. I mean, literally, it's true. If we weren't selling anything, then I wouldn't get to do this. But
that is true.
I'm really in it, you know, for the joy of making stuff. It's the only reason I'm here. But anyway, doing a dynamic mic well is very, very hard. And the Shure SM57 is a great example of a very nice dynamic mic. Now, you might not personally like the sound. You know, some of you might not like the sound. It has a characteristic sound for sure. But it has less handling noise than just about any other dynamic on the market. And the reason for that is surprising. And we did a whole video. My pal Peterson from DIYRE did an interview with some folks at Shure. John Bourne was the guy. John's a pal from Shure. And this mic was developed a long time ago. And basically, inside the handle, there is a volume of air that was very, very specifically calculated to provide a certain amount of back pressure on the back of the capsule. So that when you handle it, the vibrations of being handled cause the diaphragm to move in a way that this air volume damps or reduces those vibrations. So that's probably not 100% accurate, but we actually have a three-part video series on recording hacks where you can see John Bourne, who is the domain expert on this, explain this in better detail and more accurately as well. But we called it the secret invisible shock mount, but it's basically this kind of pneumatic shock mount that's built into the mic. Now, it's easy to copy the SM57 in the sense that you can stick a $5 moving coil cartridge from Alibaba or Transound or whatever into a handle that looks like the 57, but it won't sound the same and it won't have the same performance.
Right.
Shure does an amazing job with the design. They also drop test them. So they're robust as can be. I was at their lab outside of Chicago, and they showed me the official concrete slab where they've got a mic stand with a clutch on it. So you step on the pedal, and the whole mic stand tips over and slams the mic into this concrete pad. And the concrete was, you know, calibrated to 4 significant digits of hardness. I made that part up. And then it smashes the hell out of the grill. And then they plug it in. They're like, test, test. Yep, sounds good. So, I mean, the products are very robust. They put them almost through a dishwasher, like, you know, salt spray and humidity.
Yep.
They have a machine that takes the headphone cables and does this to them like 10,000 times.
Sure.
So those products are really over-engineered. And yet it sells for $99. You know, it's hard to sell a product for $99. It is really hard.
Yep. They
also showed me the engineering book. It was one of those things that you got in college or in high school. It's like the bound paper with all the white paper with lines in it. And the front's got this black and white speckly thing. It's one of the, I don't know what they're called, but those, one of those books that you take notes in college. And it had all of the original engineering drawings, all the volume calculations and probably the elasticity of the rubber polymers and all this stuff. And it took a PhD a summer to figure this stuff out. And, you know, that makes sense to do if you've got PhDs on staff and $1 million R&D budget, and you figure we're going to sell, you know, 10,000 pieces a year for the next 50 years.
Right.
And I don't know if 10,000 is the right number. It could be more, it could be less. I have no idea. The point is that is a volume business.
Absolutely.
And that's not the business I'm in. I'm in the business of making boutique condenser mics. We do hope to branch out to some other kinds of products, but a stage dynamic, I just don't see happening because unless you're going to develop your own moving coil cartridge, right? If you're just going to buy a Transound and stick it in a fancy shell, you know, that mic exists. There's probably 6 of those out there already. And the only difference would be the logo. And I'm not super interested in that.
Okay.
It doesn't make sense to me.
What microphone are you using right now?
So I'm using a Mini K47. This is actually a prototype of what we now call the high output edition. I mentioned before, when you sell a microphone, you don't know what people are going to use it for, meaning something loud, something quiet. And so you kind of have to build it to accommodate as many reasonable sources as you can. Because for someone who doesn't have a ton of recording experience, if all they know is they take this microphone out of the box and they stick it in front of their source and they play and it sounds bad, they think this is a bad product.
Right.
The designer might say, no, you're using it wrong, you know, but the customer's experience is valid. They wanted to record whatever it was, a loud guitar or a really quiet nylon string guitar. And if they had a bad experience with it, then for them, that's just a bad product. And so the designers would love if consumers of their products were more educated. And I go to great lengths to educate people about these kinds of issues because that helps them have a better experience, better results. Anyway, the Mini K47 was developed to accommodate as wide a range of those kinds of sources. But even in the manual, it says, you know what, this won't work on a kick drum. You know, don't put this mic on a kick drum, don't put it on a snare drum, and probably not shove it up the bell of a trumpet either, because those are very, very loud sources and the mic might clip internally, meaning it might distort internally. It won't hurt the microphone, but it won't sound good. But even if the mic has enough headroom for that loud signal, it will probably overdrive your preamp. And so it'll clip downstream and that'll sound crunchy and bad. So we spell it out in the manual. But in audio, there's always trade-offs, as you very well know. And so for people who primarily record really quiet stuff, whether that's spoken word, you know, voiceover, nylon string acoustic guitar is kind of a killer. Hammer dulcimer is challenging. Foley, sometimes percussion. Those kinds of things, you need a mic with a really high output level, high sensitivity, meaning basically it's just louder. It just sends more signal out to your preamp. And the reason that you'd want to do that is because, like I said before, circuit noise tends to be constant. It is what it is. The capsule volume relative to that can change. And so if you can turn the sort of volume of the mic way up, then you end up at the end of the cable with a higher signal to noise ratio, which is a benefit because it means you need less preamp gain, and right. Preamps add noise. People don't think of it that way. They think their mic is noisy, but if you've got your preamp on 11, guess what? You know, several dB of that is noise. Absolutely. Most consumer grade preamps are, I mean, it's actually shocking how good they are as long as you keep the gain below about half. But I've even seen kind of famous brand, you know, more pricey preamps, and you turn them up 80% of the way and you start to hear the hiss come in. It's just the nature of the beast. So if you can send in a hotter input signal, then you're just going to get better results. And so we've now introduced, as part of the Roswell Custom Shop, a high output version of this mic, the Mini K47 and the Mini K87. And in both those cases, we're basically making circuit mods to bump up the output at the expense of headroom, because it is a trade-off.
Right.
So if you come in saying, look, you know, vocals and acoustic guitar, I would say, yeah, go for it. High output, you know, because you're going to get an extra, 3 to 6 or 7 decibels of signal without any noise, without any additional noise.
And it's still a flat measuring microphone?
The Mini K47 is not flat. The 87 is.
87.
Flat, relatively speaking. I don't want to be seen making promises that are not literally true, because that would, you know, suck. So the 87 is pretty flat. It's plus 1 dB. There's some, you know, there's often like a plus 1 dB at 2 or 3, and there's plus 1 at 9 to 10, but not more than that. Flat. Yeah, we do that. We tune them. We literally tune each mic in comparison to the Goldmaster. But the 47 has that mid-range presence it's supposed to. That's the sound of it. You know, that's the vocal articulation. That's the bringing out the body of the guitar and the toms, you know, the body of the wood and the toms on drum overheads and the, you know, the instrument, the sound of the instrument, not just the strings and the piano. So the 47 is colored. It's not flat at all. It's been incorrectly, that capsule's been incorrectly described over the years as a flat response capsule, but it is not. You know, a flat response capsule wouldn't be a 47. So,
understood. I've been listening this whole time, and I have been saying to myself, he obviously has a great speaking voice. However, it sounds really good.
Oh.
And no matter how much I listen to myself, I cannot stand my own voice. However, I listen to yours and I go, wow, that sounds really good. I have to try one of these mics now.
Oh, we can make that happen.
Condenser
mics are a different deal because they have much higher sensitivity. Like the mic you're on, is that an SM7B?
Yep.
Yeah, so those have famously low sensitivity.
Yep,
like, and that's 2 millivolts.
That's why I have one of them on.
I can't see that. Is that a cloud lifter or a...
It's,
head.
It is neither, actually. It is, do you know Niant Studio?
I do. Yeah. John somebody, right?
Yes. So I forget John, his last name. Yeah. John makes these amps, and I think he's one of the few that actually gets it. Mm-hmm. So I had him make, I got myself into a really weird piano recording thing. It was really a crazy story when I never should have gotten involved, but I knew a Steinway dealer, and he was doing this. He flew in some artist, some pianist, and wanted to record it. And I'm like, oh gosh, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I'm not a recording guy. And I'm like, I'll figure something out. And I stumbled across John and ordered up a pair of mics, and I got really, really, really lucky. And the reason I say that is, like, I went home and I have a killer home system, and I put it on. I was like, oh my God, like, it almost sounds like I know what I'm doing. And I knew, I mean, nothing. All right. Everything was, you know, I got a PhD in Google, right? So I always remembered that, because I'm like, well, some of it is luck. Some of it is what I read. You know, I did the typical X crossing and just got lucky. And so when this whole thing came about and I had my gain cranked up, and it's funny you say that about the gain, because I had it about 80% and I could hear a little bit of hiss. And funny, everybody that uses this board, everybody says how quiet the preamps are. And I think to the average person, they're very quiet. But I heard it, and I'm like, that's driving me crazy. So that's how I got this little amp. So.
Yeah. Well, that should add 20 dB or so. I mean, I don't know John's design, but
I think it's about 18. But
yeah. Which is, you know, that's really helpful.
Yeah, and expensive for what, like, a cloud lifter is $150. This is $70. You know, it's you know, so.
Yeah. So what I was going to say, though, is condenser mics, not only do they have much higher output, but you don't eat the mic, and you're not eating your SM7B. But you know, if you were to use a mic like this up really close, it would be very boomy and very loud, and you'd get a lot of like breath sounds, which you don't want. Yep. Positioning these can be a little bit of a trick. You want to get it kind of out of the blast zone. I try to keep it out of camera. I know it's a little peaking in the bottom, but you know, sometimes coming in from above or off to one side is helpful. The risk of these is of any condenser, really, in this kind of context, is that it's going to hear the whole room. I did a Q&A on YouTube the other day, and you can hear my cat having a fight out the window. So that's the thing, you know, a dynamic mic, if you're in a noisy environment, having a dynamic mic that's right up next to you can give better results. So if you have a lot of like HVAC noise, kids, pets, washing machine, trucks, street noise, that sort of thing. If you're recording in a kind of compromised environment like that, then a dynamic mic up close is likely to yield better results. But if you have the luxury of a quieter space, then a condenser, large diaphragm condenser, especially, you can back it off, get it a little bit out of the frame and not right up in your face, which, you know, if you're not on camera, it doesn't matter as much, but if you're going to be on camera, you know, like, I wouldn't want to watch this podcast. That wouldn't be interesting for me. It also doesn't sound very good. But, you know, a condenser you can get further away. It's not so much in the frame, doesn't dominate the view. And it still hears plenty of detail. So,
no, absolutely. Matt, is there anything that I haven't asked that I should have?
You know, I don't have any questions that I was hoping secretly that you would ask. The way I approach my business is to try to help people. Because, you know, that's the only way that I can really be of service. I do a lot of sort of consulting and counseling via email, because microphones, you know, I get it. They're complicated. You know, you can open a Musician's Friend catalog or go into Guitar Center and be confronted, assaulted by dozens of choices, you know, everywhere from $59 to $5,000 or more. And, you know, it is not the case necessarily that the more money you spend, the better product you're going to get. Partly because it just literally isn't true sometimes, because marketing is a big piece of the price equation, but also because everyone's needs are different. And some people might need a specific thing that is better served by a lower cost product. So so what I would say is I would invite people to contact me if they have questions about what microphone to buy.
Well, I really do appreciate your time. It's very gracious, and really appreciate all the explanations technically and about your products. It's been a wonderful conversation. If anybody has any questions, please feel free to reach out to Matt at roswellproaudio.com. And I'll put all the links below. Please be sure to like and subscribe to this video and all the others. Thank you so much, Matt.
Yep. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. Find us on YouTube and Facebook at the Intellectual People Podcast and online at theintellectualpeoplepodcast.com. Check back for exciting new episodes.